Hey, this is Rob. I took the week off this week, and in my stead, I sent my A-team, consisting of one Dr. Sherry Walling, to put together an exceptional interview for you. The interview's with Greg Baguez. He's most well-known for his 2013 Business of Software talk on developers, entrepreneurs, and depression. I think you're really going to get something out of this. Even if you don't struggle with mental health issues, you probably know someone who does. Actually, the statistics indicate that you do know someone who does. So let's dive in. Welcome to the Zen Founder Podcast. I'm Rob, the founder.
And I'm Sherry, the clinical psychologist. And we've come together to help founders and their families stay sane while starting up.
Each week, we'll talk about different ways to work well, stay emotionally and physically healthy, and stay connected to the people that you care about.
My name is Greg Baguez. I serve as a developer evangelist at Twilio. And for the last couple years, I've been speaking at conferences and meetups about depression and mental illness in the tech community.
Someone told me, I can't confirm whether this is true or not, but someone told me that your talk received the only standing ovation they had ever seen at Business of Software. And did you expect that? What did it feel like to have all those folks standing up and applauding you?
It was incredibly humbling. I mean, to start with, there is no other conference that I would rather attend, let alone speak at, than the Business of Software. I've been following that for several years. And, you know, in addition to being a developer, definitely have a lot of entrepreneurial interests. And so I had watched the talks online, and I had applied to give a lightning talk the year prior and didn't get in. And so I applied to give a lightning talk on this subject, and I got accepted, and then Mark Littlewood, who runs the conference, called me a week or so later and was like, you know, we think that it might be better if we give you 30 minutes instead of the, you know, the lightning talk. And so that was just amazing. And then to have that kind of response was just really super humbling. So, yeah, it was truly one of the best experiences of my life. And I would say it goes so far as to say it was life trajectory altering, being able to meet all those people and I get all the encouragement from them that I got.
And it is an excellent talk. I rewatched it last night, and it's just such a great combination of personal story and good information and humor. For people who are listening who haven't seen it, definitely check it out because it's very good. So yeah, you've been, over the last few years especially, talking a lot about mental health issues in the startup community and the developer community. Why do you think this is so important?
The thing that I can speak most authoritatively on the topic is my story, right? And so, and from my personal experience, I had a good stretch of 5+ years where I was more or less incapacitated and certainly performing way below, you know, what my, at least I thought my potential was. I felt like I was letting down a lot of friends. I felt so much shame. I was perpetually broke and perpetually switching jobs just in time to not get fired. And I knew that I had been given certain opportunities just by nature of, you know, being a middle-class white kid that had educational opportunities available to me, that had a computer available to me. And it just really felt like I had been given a lot of opportunities and talents. And I just felt like a lazy bastard that I was squandering all of this stuff and just felt so irresponsible and just felt so much shame, like crippling shame. And today, life is just way better. And no small part because I take a pill every morning. And there's, I don't want to oversimplify that. And there's a lot of other stuff that goes in addition. But it kind of started with A, just recognizing that this might not have to do with some sort of moral or ethical failure on my part. It might be like I've been trying to run a marathon on a broken ankle here. And if I would just go get the ankle treated, then, you know, I could actually put in the work and accomplish some of the goals that I've set out. I've met a whole bunch of other people who are going through similar stuff. And I really feel like there is probably, for any given employer out there, no single way that they could boost the productivity in their workplace than by making it as acceptable for their employees to get their mental health looked at in the same way that they would get any other physical ailment looked at. I think that there's no better way that we could probably improve the quality of life for the people, you know, our peers and our friends in this industry, than by just letting them know that they don't have to be ashamed for the stuff that they're going through, and that maybe there is a reason for a lot of their suffering that they've been experiencing in their life.
You kind of felt like there was something deeply wrong with you more than the chemistry in your brain. In your talk, you made some really interesting observations, I think, about the way that perhaps the tech community works for people who are struggling with depression or ADHD or bipolar disorder, in that it's pretty okay to stay up all night. It's okay to have a pretty different sleep schedule. In your words, which I love, to grow a neck beard and talk to your shoes. It's not necessarily a field that requires you to play by the rules as you might have to if you worked at a bank or something. And it's also a place where it draws some pretty smart people, and intelligence is certainly something that can help folks cover some of the struggles that they're having. So for folks who might not be familiar with these diagnoses that we're talking about, would you just describe ADD from your perspective?
So from my perspective, one of the things that helped me understand it is when someone told me that ADD exists more on a spectrum. So first off, ADD is more of the colloquial term. I believe the official diagnosis is ADHD or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, but not everybody actually has the hyperactivity piece to it.
Yep, there are three kinds. There's combined inattention and hyperactivity. And then there's a predominantly inattentive presentation and a predominantly hyperactive or impulsive presentation. There are three different versions of attention deficit hyperactivity disorder.
And someone explained it to me and said, everybody experiences symptoms of ADD. So everybody experiences procrastination or inability to focus, et cetera. The diagnosis comes in when your experience with those symptoms interferes with your quality of life. And so for me, it was the point where I think school is probably where I really noticed it a lot. I would sit in class and I just straight up couldn't focus. Like I just could not make it through an hour long lecture and take notes and whatnot. I couldn't force myself to sit down and do homework or to study for an exam unless it was hours before the exam or hours before the homework was due. And then when there was no other option, when I was really backed into a corner or something, my brain seemed to flip and I'd be able to hyper-focus on the task at hand. And it seemed like in those times I could focus better than my friends could, you know, my, let's just say, quote unquote, normal friends. Kind of real polarization of the way my brain worked. It seemed to not work particularly well under normal circumstances, and under high pressure circumstances, it seemed to work exceedingly well.
So it's kind of a difficulty in being able to modulate attention. It's all or nothing.
And it felt like often I had no control over that at all.
And then you add to this the other layer of bipolar disorder. And what symptoms or how would you describe bipolar disorder?
Yeah, this is a good question, in part because it's difficult to kind of see bipolar disorder in yourself unless you're looking back over a long sample set. Because for me, it would look like weeks or months of depression. So this gradual slide down into just despair and lethargy. Especially, I would sleep a ton. I would sleep, 12 or 16 hours a day. It felt impossible to get out of bed before noon. So again, I just felt super lazy. And just being really pessimistic, it also would make it more difficult for me to focus and concentrate, because I'd just be really excessively worrying about a lot of things. And then for no apparent reason, sometimes I would just get huge bursts of energy and I would stay up all night. I would need very little sleep for a few days. I would be very excited. I would feel very creative. I've come up with all these ideas. I'd fill up journals. I'd start coding two or three websites, and I felt like I needed to do them all tonight and finish them, in part because I kind of knew that this feeling wouldn't last forever, so I felt like I needed to capitalize on it. And sure enough, after a few days, I would just start the slide back down into depression again. So it would be weeks of lethargy and despair, just punctuated by these moments of intense creativity and enthusiasm. And that pattern would persist kind of indefinitely.
You talked about feeling like something was wrong for several years, this sense in which you felt like you were underperforming or really not living up to your potential. How did you come to the point where you really decided you needed to seek help or really figure out what was going on in your brain?
I think that came in a couple phases. So I failed out of school, and that was particularly difficult because I had seen a bunch of my friends graduate. Again, just assumed it was because I was lazy. And I thought that maybe things would be better if I was doing something I really enjoyed, and I really enjoyed web development. So I started doing freelance web development and had a lot of the same problems. So after about a year of that, it's like, okay, I tried something different. Maybe it's the location. So I moved to Chicago and got a new job. And after a year or so, I had some of the same struggles. So I stumbled across this book called Driven to Distraction and read it, and just read a bunch of stories that were really similar to my own. And so I set up an appointment to meet with a therapist to talk about ADD. And she comes back and says, you definitely have ADD, but I think you also have bipolar. And I had probably been considering the ADD thing for a year or so. And so I was ready to accept that. I was not ready to accept the bipolar thing. And so I started treatment for ADD in the form of taking meds and going to support groups and meeting with a therapist, but pretty much was stayed in denial about the bipolar thing for the next couple of years. And the ADD meds helped a lot. I was able to focus for the first time and make a list and cross things methodically off the list. It was really helpful, but they also exacerbated my depression. Finally, after a couple of years, you know, I was just on the brink of getting fired again. And just really felt like I was at the end of my rope, and I was just hurting people around me. You know, I was hurting my parents, who had to step in and financially support me on the months when I couldn't meet my rent. And it was just painful for them to watch me go through that. And I was hurting my friends every time I told them I would show up someplace and didn't, and then hurting my employers. And so that's finally, like, we're just, I think sadly it was after exhausting all other options. I met with a psychiatrist, and within a few weeks I was taking meds, and it absolutely was not like a light switch flipped on, but over the next few months, like, life just steadily got better.
You've talked a little bit about how that particular set of symptoms obviously impaired your functioning and has gotten the way of maybe some things that you would have liked to have done in your life. But you've also talked a little bit about some of the strengths, or how some of that ability to hyperfocus or have these bursts of energy was useful to you as a coder or as a creative person.
Most recently, tragically, Robin Williams passed away. He committed suicide. And I don't think that he was officially diagnosed with bipolar, or at least he didn't say he was, but some of his friends came out and see that. It seems to be a fairly common diagnosis amongst a lot of comedians, especially. And then more broadly speaking, amongst a lot of artists and in general people who create. We know that bipolar kind of correlates with higher risk tolerances. So if you take creativity plus increased risk tolerances, you often find bipolar to show up in a lot of entrepreneurs. I do think that it kind of causes you to see the world in a different way than the people around you. So I would, at this point in my life, if you were to check in with me right before I was born and say, hey, like, here's the thing, here's the pluses that come along with this, and here's the minuses that come along with this, do you want it or not? I would probably take it. My bipolar, my ADD describe both my greatest strengths and my greatest weaknesses. The difficulty came in recognizing that that was what was going on, and then learning how to organize my life in such a way to mitigate the weaknesses and to play to my strengths as much as possible.
And I think that's such an important message. You know, as you shared earlier, there's this deep sense of shame that goes along with some of these experiences, and the ability to look at some of these patterns as illness, as something that needs to be treated and cared for and paid attention to, but to also see some of the strengths in it or some of the richness that it brings to your life, I think is such an important message for folks who are experiencing some of these challenges. Would you say a little bit about what treatment has looked like for you?
Well, so I started off taking meds for ADD. So I took a stimulant called dexedrine, which is very similar to Adderall. The stimulants are really interesting. The doctor said, we're going to prescribe these to you. You're going to take it. And 15 minutes later, you're going to have an idea if it works or not. And sure enough, it did. Like 15 minutes later, it's like, holy shit. Like, is this how everybody else feels? You know, it's just kind of blinders came on and I could focus on the thing in front of me. I took those for about 5 years, regularly every day. I don't take them regularly. I still take them on occasion now, but it's more of on an as needed basis. 2 years after that, I started taking Lamictal or Lamotrigine, one's the brand name, and that is a mood stabilizer, and very different experience there. I take it every morning, and there was no light bulb that went off. It was just 3 months after I started taking them, kind of looked back and said, oh, you know, if that thing that happened to me yesterday had happened to me 3 months ago, I would be incapacitated right now. Or, oh, look, I've gotten out of bed before noon every day this week. And it takes a while to build up in your system. But just gradually, it just was like the low, I just noticed that the low points weren't happening anymore. So I've been, as far as meds go, taking those for about 6 years now, I think. And then in addition to the meds, I met with a therapist for about 5 years and personally just hit the point of diminishing marginal returns there, would not hesitate to go back at any moment. But I think that these things are, these conditions are really difficult because it's hard to separate what's caused by the difficult situations in your life and kind of the programming that happened to your brain through repetition over time. And then what's biochemical, and then the two definitely influence each other. So I was dealing with a lot of shame because I couldn't get out of bed every morning and I couldn't follow through on responsibilities and whatnot. And so then once the biochemical stuff started being addressed, I had a lot of unpacking to do with a mental health professional, with a therapist, to figure out how to get rid of some of the shame and to figure out how, you know, things that happened in childhood had contributed to that, like patterns through school and whatnot, to figure out how to, you know, I think for a long time I had adopted a position of being a people pleaser because I knew I was going to let people down in these other ways. So the parts I did have control over, I wanted to make sure that I went out of my way to please them in those realms. So figuring out how to engage in healthy conflict with people now that I could trust myself to follow through and I didn't need to rely on people pleasing as kind of like a trump card. And so therapy was fantastic. I recommend it to everybody. It's kind of just a life coach that will help you figure out what's going on. I equate the two with, you know, if I was trying to run a marathon and I broke my leg, I would go see a medical doctor to help me get my leg set and to treat the, you know, the quote unquote physical condition or the physical condition there. And then I would see a trainer who, once I was physically healthy, would help me figure out the optimal way to train for the marathon. And so the therapist is my trainer and the psychiatrist is the MD.
It's a great analogy.
Thank you.
How has your own sense of shame changed as you've talked so much and so publicly about your experience?
That is such a good question. You know, so much of shame is a question of what other people think of us. And before I started giving this talk, you know, the first couple of times I gave it, right before I get up on stage, there's just this voice in the back of my head that's like, don't do this. You know, these people are going to shun you and they're going to think less of you. And it has just been exactly the opposite of that. I mean, again, like what an incredible honor to get a standing ovation from the, you know, 200-300 of the people that I admire most, business software, for basically getting up on stage and talking about how I almost got fired because I, you know, couldn't show up to work until noon every day. And what I found is just that I greatly underestimated people's capacity for sympathy and for empathy. And I think I just, in general, thought that everyone in the world, and especially in the tech community, was way more of an asshole than they actually are. In general, it turns out not only are people very accepting when you admit weakness, but people have weaknesses of their own, and people wish that they felt freedom to speak about those things instead of hiding them. And so when you open up about these things, it kind of gives people permission to do the same, either to you individually or publicly. So incredibly supportive. That's been the biggest surprise at all. I would say two things. One is that how many other people come up and say, me too. And if it's not me too, I go through this myself. It's me too. I have a coworker or a friend or a spouse or a sibling who goes through this stuff. That pretty much covers everybody. So this is that, you know, mental illness is something that has affected literally everybody in our community.
Yeah.
And then just how encouraging they are. It's just been unbelievable how encouraging people have been about this stuff.
It's neat to hear that you've had such an encouraging reception. I mean, I think I think you're absolutely right. People are so affected by mental illness and related concerns, and to open the door and allow people to talk about it or give people permission to talk about it by creating the safety of sharing your own experience is so powerful. I'm hoping that the conversations that you've been having are doing something to change some of the stigma in the tech community about mental illness.
That's been, I mean, easily the most rewarding thing I've ever done in my career is these emails that I get from people who say, hey, I saw your talk. You could have been describing my life. I set up an appointment with a therapist or a psychiatrist, and I got started on meds, or I got started with seeing a therapist on a weekly basis, and life is better. And I have a job now, or I'm doing better at my job now, or my marriage is better because we can communicate about this stuff, and my wife has a better idea of why I do the things we do, and we figure out ways to work around that. I mean, it's just been not something that I necessarily set out to do, and it's just been an incredible opportunity, just a huge blessing to be able to like play a small part in that role, and literally just happened by telling my story, right? Like, I'm not an expert on this stuff. I've read a few books, but I haven't done any academic studies or anything. I mean, most 80% of my talk is just me getting up there and just being like, hey, this is what happened to me. But there's something about that that gives other people permission to do the same thing. And then once they've shared that with somebody, then they can often feel like some of the shame's diminished. They can go get help for it.
So for someone who is hearing our conversation and feeling like we might be talking about them or to them or about someone they know, what do you say to that? How do you respond? What encouragement or recommendations do you offer?
Talk to someone about it, and ideally talk to a professional about it. People, I think that oftentimes it's easy to diminish the expertise that psychiatrists or therapists have. They've spent as long as you spent learning how to program, and probably longer. They spent learning how to diagnose these conditions and how to point people in the direction of the right treatment for them. That process of setting up an appointment is one of the most painful things that you'll probably do in terms of just in general being a pain in the ass. You have to deal with insurance and there's paperwork involved, and you're probably going to have to pick up the phone because a lot of mental health professionals, they don't use email particularly well, and they don't have the cool little just set up an appointment via the website feature. Which, by the way, I tell everyone this, and you have an entrepreneurial audience listening to this, like, someone please like solve that problem. If I were going to start a company today, it would be to take these people who email me and say, I want to see someone, to, they press a big red button on the internet somewhere, and 5 minutes later they have their first appointment set up, or they see someone through Skype or whatever. But fight through that process, as difficult as it can be, because as I look back over my life, it's difficult to where you can pinpoint a moment or a decision that you made and say that moment altered the trajectory of my life. And when I look back, I can see very clearly the couple times, first with that therapist and then second with the psychiatrist, where the trajectory of my life shifted 20 degrees in a better direction. It truly has been life-changing for me and life-changing for others. And it's easily the best investment I've ever made of time or money in terms of the return on investment. You got to figure that everything in your life kind of stems from the decisions that your brain makes. So if you can rest that, life just gets better.
So, I'm going to ask you a little bit of a different question, and maybe this is for my own motivation, but what do you think mental health professionals need to know about developers?
It's an interesting question. No one's asked me that before. I think the first thing they need to know is that they don't like talking on the phone, and they don't like filling out paperwork, and they have very little patience for poorly designed websites and for bad processes. I think there's very few times I could say this, but I think that if you are a therapist or a psychiatrist and you invest some time into making your website a little bit more friendly, you can literally save lives. Like, there are people who are dying out there because they didn't get that first appointment set up. They tried to, and they found the Yelp of psychiatrists. There's a couple of sites out there, but then these people who are already dealing with anxiety and already paralyzed and already have problems with organization and whatnot, they look at this list of 30 people and they don't know how to choose the person who you're going to tell your most intimate secrets to. They, you know, they're not particularly good at keeping a calendar and et cetera, et cetera. So if we can make that process better, anything you can do as a professional to make it easier for someone to get in your front door and to establish a pattern, I think is super beneficial and probably is going to mean keeping hours that are later in the day. You know, not a lot of people struggling with this stuff just are simply not going to make a 9 a.m. appointment. I think that'd be super helpful. And then I also think that just knowing that a lot of these people are perhaps more analytical than your average person. And so they think very logically. Their job is to find in 1,000 lines of code to find the one thing in there that is logically incorrect. And so just know that they're going to respond really well to analogies that have to do with like systems being broken or like bugs in the system. And they're probably going to want to understand like a very logical, like A, B, C, therefore D, as opposed to perhaps more touchy-feely kind of things.
So the kind of therapy that you just described is cognitive therapy or cognitive behavioral therapy. So if I could add a little bit, one of the things Please. That folks might want to do when they're looking for a mental health professional is to look for someone who at least has some training in cognitive therapy. They're going to be able to work with that logical, analytical orientation in a better way than maybe another kind of therapist.
Yeah, what's the difference between CBT and what would you call the more traditional therapy?
I mean, there are lots of different systems of therapy, and you know, the first system, the original, is made famous by Freud, which really looks at the relationships between the past and the present, and that is really meaningful. Not to minimize that at all. Most people don't practice pure Freudian psychology anymore, but looking at some of the connections between who we were as a kid and the things that happened to us when we were young and vulnerable and the way that we approach the world now, it can be a pretty important conversation. But cognitive therapy is really looking at the relationship between the way that you think, a thought that lives in your head, and how you feel or interact with the environment. So one of the things that cognitive therapists might do are look for kind of logical errors in the way that you're thinking about the world. And so when you talked about finding that one logical problem in hundreds of lines of code, that sounds a lot like what a cognitive therapist would do, which is to hear you talk about your life and hear you talk about your story and look for the basic mistakes, or we call them sometimes maladaptive cognitions, the logical errors in how you're thinking about the world.
That's so cool. Hey, what would you, I'm sorry to like turn this around. From your perspective, if there is someone out there who wanted to see a therapist for the first time, what's a good thing for them to look for? How do you make that decision?
It's always helpful to get a recommendation from your physician or a friend. Don't be shy about asking questions about someone's qualifications or the kinds of patients that they usually work with. Don't be shy about asking them what they think about what you've told them and getting a sense of their approach to your problem early on, even after the first couple sessions. As I mentioned earlier, there are lots of different kinds of therapies, and lots of different kinds of therapies work. Probably the most important factor is what we call working alliance, is whether the person that you're working with seems to understand you and you seem to understand them, whether you find them to be competent and helpful and trustworthy. And if you meet with someone and you think they're weird and you don't understand their language, then meet with someone else. It's not quite like dating, but you don't necessarily need to settle down with the first therapist that you have a meeting with. Lots of therapists will give a free initial consultation while you're in the process of deciding whether this is someone that you want to commit to treatment with. And I think you're absolutely right about some of the barriers to getting into treatment. You know, those of us who are doing this work, we're not very technical. I work at a big psychiatric clinic, and it's a great place, and we have fantastic people working there, and I think we provide great service to the people that we serve. But yeah, our website sucks, and it's sort of hard to get an appointment, and it's a clunky process because we're not technologists. psychologists and psychiatrists. And so in a way, we're having this like cultural gap between developers and startup folks and, you know, the mental health community.
Great opportunity for all you entrepreneurs out there to address some of these problems that Sherry is talking about, you know, to help healthcare providers figure out how to tackle the internet better, to help lower the friction to getting some of these people of a younger generation to see a therapist for the first time. A lot of people, okay, so I was pretty close to getting fired and I couldn't have done a job for a while. And so I didn't have insurance. And I got really fortunate that at the time when I finally decided to get the stuff treated, I had insurance. And in no small part, my decision to do that was because I knew that if I lost my insurance, that window of opportunity was going to close. If you don't have insurance because you've had a hard time staying employed, what's a good way for people to go see a therapist or a psychiatrist?
If you don't have insurance, the thing that I would recommend doing is go to the nearest major university that has a doctoral training program or even a master's level training program and see what services they provide. There are some fantastic folks who are training, who are getting all their hours to get licensed, who are often a part of these training programs, and they are well supervised and their training is recent and a lot of them are kind of the same generation or they're younger folks. So if you don't have insurance, that those are really great resources because usually they're, you know, they're cash pay or they're sliding scale or they're low fee clinics.
That's such a good idea. I haven't heard that before. Oh, also as another tip for anyone who has meds that they need to take, but they don't have insurance. I have, thankfully, pretty good insurance now, but I still fill my Lamictal at Costco. I think the membership to Costco costs like $60, and I get a 3 or 4 month supply of my meds for like $30 or $40, whereas it costs me $15 a month if I fill it with insurance at Walgreens. So it's actually way cheaper for me to do it without insurance at Costco. And I feel like Walmart and some other places have some pretty good deals on filling meds. So just don't assume, like if you can get that prescription or whatever, don't assume that just because you don't have insurance that you won't be able to do the meds. Like they're, for some meds, in some cases, they're actually affordable.
And a physician can also help you figure out how to get maybe samples from a pharmaceutical rep or connect you with discount cards to get medicines that you need that may not be covered by your insurance. There are definitely hacks. There are ways to do it and get the care that you need, even if you have limited resources or don't have insurance right now.
That's great.
So Greg, last couple questions. I just wonder, as you look back into some of the lower moments of your life, was there a thought or a piece of hope that you held on to that really kind of helped you keep going?
So when I was in school, that was probably the darkest time. It's like my fifth year, I'm failing out of school, probably between my parents and I, $80,000 in the hole, and there's no degree in sight. And such a disappointment. I was hiding the fact that I was failing out from my parents because I thought they'd be deeply ashamed of me. And so I wanted to die. Like I was praying at night, you know, God, like don't wake me up. And like even thinking about it, like I don't know where you cross the line into saying I was suicidal or not, but certainly I think the analytical side of me was evaluating options. I remember thinking like, oh, I want to die because my parents are so ashamed of me and I've caused them all this pain, but there's literally nothing I could do that would cause them more pain than dying. Like that would be way worse.
So you're sort of bound by your own logic there.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And so I had taken a semester off and worked at Disney World for 4 months, and we went skydiving while we were down there. And I always thought, man, if I didn't have all these responsibilities, it'd be so cool just to like become a professional skydive instructor. It'd be so irresponsible. It's not a good programming job or whatever. And I was like, man, if I'm seriously considering dying, it would make way more sense just to sell everything I own and move to Florida and become a skydiving instructor, because as disappointed as my parents might be with me failing out of school, with me squandering the opportunity becoming a skydiving instructor, they'd be way less disappointed with that than if I killed myself. And also I'd be squandering less opportunity if I did that than if I killed myself. So that was one thought, was just kind of like this evaluation of opportunities. The other thing was, I think I got to this point where I was like, okay, so let's just say that my life is not worth anything to me. That is actually kind of a valuable resource to have. Like, if I'm willing to die, then let's see if it wouldn't make more sense to like find whatever the equivalent is of jumping on the grenade. You know, like if I have this resource that is not worth anything to me, but perhaps we could trade that in for somebody else getting some benefit, then maybe we could do that. And so it seems like it'd be kind of silly just to throw this thing away that could be useful to other people. So I didn't go join the military or anything like that. But in retrospect, you know, now it's been an incredible honor to having gone through this, to have been able to take that experience and help other people who are going through that dark time. And then, you know, the hope that I didn't have, that I just straight up couldn't see back then. It's like today I truly have the best job in the world that I could have. The developer evangelist role at Twilio it's the perfect job for me. My wife and I got married 5 years ago, and 10 weeks ago we had a daughter, and she's pretty cool. And I could not have envisioned that. Like, life is just super good right now. And I just never, like when I was laying in bed 13 years ago, hoping I would die, I couldn't have seen that. And in fact, I did not get the degree, but a few months ago, I got invited by the computer science department at University of Illinois to come back and speak. And I spoke to about 200 students of the CS department there, and I was invited by the dean of the undergrad program. And that was so incredibly gratifying. Like, I was in the largest lecture hall on the CS campus, like four blocks away from the apartment that I was living in at that time when I was wishing that I was dead, speaking to the CS students about the reason why I failed out 12 years prior.
I love that you got to go back in that role. That's so pretty neat completion of the circle.
Yeah, it was way better than getting a degree. It was so, so cool.
I think that is one of the things about having a really logical mind, is that there are all kinds of possibilities that are outside of your logic. All kinds of things have happened to you in your life in the last 15 years that you didn't expect and you didn't see coming.
Yeah, I mean, if there's anything that those who are involved in technology know, it's that we just have no idea what 5 years from now looks like.
Speaking of future opportunities, at one point you were talking a little bit about writing a book about developers and depression. Are you still working on that?
I am. I stalled on it so bad, and I think that I psyched myself out. I've decided to embrace the mantra from all of you who are listening and just ship it early and often. So I've got it up on LeanPub right now. And my goal is, I don't know when this podcast is coming out, but my goal is about 7 days from now just to turn on what I have. And what I'm looking to do is just kind of tell my story. So there'll be some chapters of just my story, and then some chapters of some, you know, just advice that I've learned and from talking to other people. And then I want to just invite other people and give other developers and people in the space to share their stories too. So
fantastic. We'll include it in the show notes too, so people can reach it that way. Well, Greg, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me. And also thank you for the risks that you've taken in bringing this topic to light and reaching out to the developer community about mental health. And from where I sit, it's just so fantastic to see the conversation happening. And you have done a lot to push the conversation forward. So I'm grateful for you and your time that you took today. So thank you very much.
It truly, on all accounts, is my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Zen Founder.
We'll be back next week with another conversation about how to enjoy a little bit more Zen in your startup life.